Welcome to Single Malt History with Gareth Russell, pouring out your serving of pure, distilled, intoxicating, and occasionally delicious history. Hello, I am absolutely delighted to be joined today on Single Malt History by the Marquess of Anglesey, who is here to discuss his new biography of his ancestor William Paget. The Great Survivor of the Tudor Age is a thrilling exploration of William Paget's journey from being a young Londoner born in the reign of King Henry VII and his rise to become a Member of Parliament, a diplomat and courtier to Henry VIII, a counsellor to Edward VI, who created him a baron, a supporter of Lady Jane Grey, who was forgiven by Mary I and died in the reign of Elizabeth I. Paget was born in the reign of the first Tudor and died in the reign of the last. And through the maniacal spinning of fortune's wheel in the 1500s, he survived and flourished. Lord Anglesey, welcome to Single Malt History, and what a remarkable topic to discuss.
Thank you very much for having me, Gareth, and I'm excited to be here.
Well, thank you. The Great Survivor of the Tudor Age, your book, begins with, I think, a wonderful foreword of you as a young boy learning about your family's origins. What in adulthood drew you to telling the story of William?
Well, I grew up in the family stately home, Plasnewydd, on the island of Anglesey, in the days before it became part of the National Trust. And there in the hallway, there were three portraits of the man who was described to me as the founder of the family, Lord William Paget. He was a very imposing Tudor gent, sporting a weird forked beard. I was slightly curious about my family's history, but mainly my life went in other directions. I remained interested in history generally and in Tudor history specifically, and like most of the world, I read Hilary Mantel. But then in 2019, I met the renowned, indeed notorious, Tudor historian David Starkey. That was at the Bangor University History Festival, where he was talking about Henry VIII, and I was talking about another ancestor, the first Marquess of Anglesey, who was second in command to Wellington at Waterloo and famously lost his leg there. David Starkey went on to me about how interesting and important William Paget was and how he hadn't been studied or written about properly. So I did start to research him a bit and find out that Starkey was absolutely right. Paget was fascinating, important, and had been little acknowledged by both academic and popular historians. Then lockdown came. I found my diary empty, so I decided I'd try and write the book.
Well, we know that William was born sometime in the later years of King Henry VII. What else do we know of his origins and childhood? Was he born into prominence or rise to it?
Well, we know very little. His father might have been a sheep shearer, a barber, a constable, or a debt collector. And in the very class-conscious society of Tudor England, William was not too keen to dwell on his low birth. When he was investigating the snobbish Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey, for treason, Howard accused him of being a mean creature and a catchpole, i.e. a debt collector. And then later, when Paget was briefly out of favour in Edward VI's reign, was imprisoned and stripped of his Order of the Garter, it was thrown in his face that he was no gentleman, either on his father or his mother's side. So, like Wolsey and Cromwell, he was a self-made man. He was evidently very clever and managed to attend first St. Paul's School and then Trinity Hall, Cambridge. His first patron was Bishop Gardiner, and then, when Thomas Cromwell became the man, Paget threw in his lot with him.
Well, Elizabeth III of Henry VIII's six queens, Jane Seymour, that Paget really becomes a prominent figure at court by serving as her secretary and continuing in the same role for her successor, Anne of Cleves. What kind of service did he perform for the Queen's consort?
Well, before he became Jane Seymour and then Anne of Cleves' secretary, he had worked in a variety of different roles under Cromwell. And he'd also travelled abroad to various parts of what is now Germany and France to gain support from princes and academics for Henry VIII's great matter, his divorce from Catherine of Aragon, the marriage to Anne Boleyn. He acted as Jane Seymour's secretary, dealing with her correspondence and organising her retinue of about 200 servants. And he performed a similar role for Anne of Cleves. For Anne, it was important that he spoke her language, German, which, of course, Henry didn't. And when that marriage went wrong, William Paget was the man who arranged for her attendants, 263 of them, I believe, to return to Cleves, and he travelled with them.
As he rises, William invests quite a lot of money into a splendid new home. What was he like in private with his family?
Well, as he became successful and powerful, he built a house at West Drayton, next to what is now Heathrow Airport. It was a pretty impressive mansion of over 50 rooms, probably roughly in the style of Hampton Court. But all that now survives, there aren't any pictures, and all that now survives is the gatehouse. But there is an inventory of the contents, which allows us to create a picture of what it was like. It was evidently a pretty large household with, amongst others, a resident priest, a steward, an estate manager, a clerk of the kitchen, a cook, kitchen boys, a butcher, also a candle maker, butcher, baker, candle maker, a horsekeeper, and a wagoner. And there are many fascinating details in that inventory about the food and drink, the entertainments, the furniture, the decor, etc. For example, there were five guest suites, each of them designed around a colour: purple, red, yellow, orange, and green. And each had wood panelling, lashings of velvet and satin, featuring the Paget coat of arms. And they were hung with rich, important, imported tapestries, all pretty impressive for the son of a catchpole. From what we know of William as a private family man, he appears to have been very devoted to his wife, Anne. She was an heiress, but it does seem to have been a love match. And he was devastated when, while abroad on a diplomatic mission, he had news that she had died of the plague. In fact, that story was wrong, and she survived, much to his delight. And they had nine children who all survived childhood, which, you know, as you know, was very rare in those days. Mm. They were, I guess, truly blessed. And although coming from pretty humble origins, it does appear that William was pretty cultured, collecting books, having friendships with well-known European humanists, and in particular supporting English musicians, you know, such as Thomas Tallis.
Alex, in the book, you recount a conversation with your father, to whom the book is dedicated, who believed that one of the reasons that William Paget was able to weather so many of the storms at the Tudor court was because he was willing to change his religion to suit the governments. Do you think that was a major component to his success, or do you think there were other factors that you came across in your research?
Well, not so much that he changed his religion to suit the government. I think it's more that he was always had a moderate attitude, generally Christian, but not fanatical. And unlike the fanatics on both the evangelical and Roman Catholic side, he didn't think it was necessary to torture, burn at the stake, or behead those who disagreed, you know, about such things as in communion, whether the bread and wine actually turned into Christ's body and blood, or only metaphorically. And those fanatics, of course, were not only prepared to force their views on others, but were also prepared to be martyrs themselves often. But what William Paget did care passionately about was that the country shouldn't tear itself apart in a bloody civil war because of such disagreements. And he survived and thrived, really, under four very different monarchs, because as well as being obviously very intelligent and hardworking, he was, unlike Wolsey or Cromwell, a very modest man who merely tried to steer the monarchs in more peaceful, moderate directions. Obviously, he didn't wholly succeed. Henry was often a brutal tyrant and launched unnecessary wars against the French. Protector Somerset was extreme in his evangelical religious views and in warring against the Scots. And Mary, as we all know, burned about 300 Protestants at the stake. But I think the thing is, things could have been, in fact, a lot worse And indeed, they were a lot worse in England during the Wars of the Roses and over much of continental Europe in the 16th century.
Well, it is certainly a torturous environment at court in Henry VIII's later years, especially after the execution of his fifth wife in 1542. In those last years, let's say from 1543 until the king's death in 1547, you paint, I think, a vivid picture of William's duties as he must liaise with the gentlemen of the Privy Chamber and manage Henry's irascible moods. What was his work life like in those years?
He was obviously a workaholic. He was always at work. I mean, there are occasions when he slightly complains, everyone else has gone home or out hunting and I'm still working. But his formal position was chief secretary, same as Cromwell. And like Cromwell, he had to, you know, be a combination of a courtier and an administrator, and constantly liaising between Henry and Henry's privy chamber, the gents who hung out with him day and night, and the somewhat more formal privy council. So access to the king's ear was everything, power and patronage. And I reckon after Cromwell's demise, Paget really had that power more than anybody else. For example, in matters of religious practices, which were in a sense the hottest political hot potatoes of that day, Paget could influence Henry quite considerably, I think. I mean, an example was when Henry refused Archbishop Cranmer's request for the removal of all statues from churches, in that sort of rather more extreme evangelical direction. Paget persuaded the king to pursue, and he told Cranmer this is what he was doing, to pursue an alternative evangelical reform for services to be conducted in English. And he read Henry pretty well in that instance, because Henry agreed to that. And of course, in the last years of Henry's reign, there was this big factional power struggle going on between the Catholic-inspired conservatives, led by the Howard family and Bishop Gardiner, and the more Protestant faction, led by Edward Seymour and others. And Paget was pretty crucial in the triumph of the reformers, steering Henry in an anti-Howard, anti-Gardiner direction.
You confront one of the great mysteries and debates of Tudor history, Henry VIII's will. Can you tell our listeners a little about its controversy and William's alleged role in it?
Ah, Henry's will. Paget, he was right in the thick of it. I mean, we think it's not utterly proven, but we think he probably drafted him. And it is a very complicated story. You know, lots to do with like the dry stamp, which wasn't actually Henry's signature and was inked in by others, or possibly inked in by Henry. But without going into all the convoluted details, I reckon my conclusion is that it was probably partly genuine and partly reflected Henry's wishes, but was equally half really slanted, if not outright forged, to favour the interests of Edward Seymour. Actually, Seymour was actually this time the Earl of Hertford, and shortly thereafter, he becomes the Duke of Somerset. The names do get quite confusing. But what is clear is that Henry's will favoured rule by a council of several men. But what actually happened, due partially to the machinations of Paget, was the king-like rule of one man, Somerset.
Henry VIII dies in 1547 to be succeeded by his son, the child King Edward VI, in whose reign William joins the aristocracy by being ennobled as a baron. How did William's life change in the 6 years of Edward VI's reign?
Well, Gareth, in Edward VI's reign, William Paget's life was very up and down. Prison one day, peerage the next. In the first part of the reign, he was essentially Somerset's right-hand man. But throughout that time, he was arguing strongly against a lot of Somerset's rather foolish policies, his extreme anti-Catholic policy and his aggressive war with Scotland, which he was obsessed with. And when Somerset finally lost power because of those ill-judged policies and was deposed in a coup, I mean, actually, there were two coups, but the the one where he was finally got rid of, and Paget also lost power. And Paget was imprisoned in the Tower of London, and it was touch and go as to whether he would lose his head. Somerset did lose his. But through, it's not quite clear how, but through skillful networking, paying a fine, they managed to get it reduced, possibly a bit of bribery, the advocacy of friends, he still had many friends in the Privy Council, and the advocacy of his very impressive wife, Anne. There's one letter where she pleads for him to be allowed out of prison. But he managed to bounce back. And by the end of Edward's reign, he was fully back, with his Order of the Garter reinstated, and he was made a baron.
He certainly merited your sobriquet for him, Alex, the great survivor of the Tudor age, through the events of 1553, when he supported Lady Jane Grey as heiress to Edward VI, but was forgiven when the crown was instead won by Edward's Catholic sister, Queen Mary I. Why did William throw his lot in with Lady Jane, and why was he rehabilitated by Queen Mary?
The simple answer as to why he supported Lady Jane Grey and then switched to Mary was because Lady Jane Grey initially seemed to be stronger, but then it became more and more apparent that Mary would win. But while I was writing the book, I was watching that great TV series, Succession, about the power struggle for succession in the business empire, obviously a half model on that of Rupert Murdoch's. And I was really struck by the parallel with the intrigues of the Tudor court. For example, as the son launches a coup to unseat the old man, he asks one of the important investors for his support in the next day's vote of confidence. And the latter replies, "I can promise you that I am spiritually and morally and ethically 100% behind whoever wins." You know, that does seem pretty much like Paget's behaviour. But, you know, it's not entirely a question of cynical self-interest. Mary definitely had greater legitimacy than Lady Jane Grey. And, you know, there are plenty of people who were on the religiously entirely on the side of... in terms of religion, entirely on the side of Lady Jane Grey, but felt that Mary should be queen because she had much greater legitimacy. And Paget didn't just follow the change of allegiance. He was important in leading it, I believe. There's a report that I think other historians haven't really noticed or made a big deal about, that at a crucial moment, there was a gathering in William Paget's house in West Drayton of the retainers of bigwigs from Oxfordshire, Buckinghamshire, Berkshire, and Middlesex, all in support of Mary's claim. And the report, although it was probably a bit exaggerated, claims that this was a gathering of 10,000 men. And even if those numbers were less, that would have been a very significant moment in the move towards Mary's victory. And it was Paget, along with the Earl of Arundel, who rode from London down to Mary's base at Framlingham Castle in Suffolk to present her. They came with just the two of them, 30 horsemen, to give her the Great Seal of State, essentially handing her the crown. And then there's a nice little story, which is probably not true, but from the Spanish ambassador, that Paget and Arundel then knelt in front of Mary with daggers pointed to their own stomachs, offering their lives and begging for forgiveness for having initially supported Lady Jane Grey. They were, of course, forgiven. And Paget continued as an important politician in Mary's reign.
He lives for another decade after the dramatic downfall of Lady Jane, the nine-day queen, in 1553. Was it a more quiet decade for him than the ones which had come before?
Not really a quiet time. No, in Mary's reign, there was this ongoing struggle between her advisors who were pushing aggressively for a full and forcible return to Catholicism and those who favoured moderation and reconciliation. And that struggle was often personified in the eyes of contemporaries as a struggle between William Paget and Bishop Gardiner. Bishop Gardiner, incidentally, I think I mentioned earlier, was his first Paget's first patron, mm-hmm. and they had a fairly up and down relationship throughout their lives, though they were reconciled before Gardiner died. But anyhow, in the first bit of Mary's reign, there was this struggle going on. And the other big thing Paget was up to in Mary's reign was negotiating her marriage to Philip II of Spain. Negotiations took many, many months, and Paget was, he was already very highly regarded by the Emperor Charles V, and negotiated the marriage with Charles, really, of his son Philip to Mary. And Paget was made sure that the terms were very favourable from the British point of view. For example, if Mary were to predecease Philip, his interest in England would end. And Philip also swore to preserve the laws and customs of England, to keep Englishmen in his household, because there was a big worry about, you know, the crown is going to be surrounded by a load of Spaniards, and not to force England to go to war against France, although they did for a bit, not very seriously, but he agreed not to do that, and not to remove Mary from England. Also, both Paget and the Emperor Charles V urged Mary to govern by mild methods rather than by violence and bloodletting. Obviously, they were only partly successful in this. But as I said earlier, it could have been worse. And Paget and the Emperor and his advisors also urged Mary not to force the return of dissolved monastery land to the church. William Paget, most of the ruling elite, had obviously had a strong personal interest in that. And they succeeded there. Though, of course, who knows what would have happened had Mary either had an heir or lived longer.
So William, Lord Paget, dies in 1563. He's survived by his wife and their 9 children, Henry, Thomas, Charles, Ethelreda, Eleanor, Griswold, Jane, Dorothy, and Anne. I think anyone interested in familial histories or histories of the aristocracy will be fascinated by your book's final chapter, Alex, reflecting on your family's experiences in the century since 1563. How did William's children continue or alter his legacy?
So, religion played a major role in the immediate legacy. Anne, William's widow, was always and definitely a Roman Catholic. That wasn't necessarily a huge problem for her under Elizabeth, but two of her sons, of William and her sons, Charles and Thomas, certainly did create a problem because they were actively involved in the Catholic conspiracies against Elizabeth. And as a result, the Paget estates were confiscated. But luckily for the future fortunes of the Paget family, my family, the brothers ended up by emulating their father in one crucial respect, by finally choosing the winning side. Because after the death of Mary, Queen of Scots, and the failure of the Armada, the Catholic exiles split into two groups, the Spanish party favouring the claims of the Spanish Infanta, and the Scottish party favouring the claims of James VI of Scotland. The Paget brothers became associated with the Scottish faction. So in the first years of the next reign, the government of James VI of Scotland, who of course became James I of England, their position was pretty fully restored, and the Paget's position was back to where they had been, and their land and estates were returned to them.
Alex, I would like to thank you very much for joining us today, and I can very much recommend your book.
It was a great pleasure speaking to you, Gareth, and thank you very much.
The Great Survivor of the Tudor Age by Alex Anglesey is out now and available online and in all good bookstores. My thanks to my guest, Lord Anglesey, and to you all for your time, which leaves me only to wish you a safe and happy week. I've been Gareth Russell, and thank you.